Manchester was the cool. Don't worry, it descends into chaos from now on. Manchester was the coolest city in the UK, the Hacienda, the coolest club on the planet, and we were, as Richard said, all mad for it. Manchester was also home to the best radio station in the country, Piccadilly. And at that time, very few, if any, commercial radio stations had such a collection of creative talent, both in front and behind the microphone. From Horizontal Dancing at Night with Curly Shirley, to Sweeney, Susie, Phil Wood, and Timmy on the Tranny, the unearned talent was unmatched. Piccadilly Radio was literally the heart and soul of Manchester. Each DJ had their pictures looming large over Piccadilly Gardens. I remember Tony Ingham telling me at my interview, "Look at that, kidder, larger than life, larger than life." Apologies, Tony, for the impersonation. This talent was aided by the best producers in the business, John Clayton, Tim Grundy, Simon Cole, Paul Lockett, and Mark Radcliffe. Simply put, Piccadilly Radio 30 years ago was a creative goldmine. And I think it wasn't a coincidence that all these people appeared at the same place at the same time. So this session isn't going to be a retrospective on Pic. It was the best. End of story. Instead, we're going to ask why it happened and what it was like to manage not only all of this creativity, but also try to make some money at it at the same time. Was it just a moment in time, or was there something else that made Piccadilly so special, so unique? I joined Piccadilly as a student studying for my A-levels and was fortunate to spend nearly 5 years at the station. As I went through university and emerged as a producer, I remember producing Tim Grundy on The Breakfast Show and deciding that we should play every record just that little bit faster because it was the morning, and if we speeded them up, it gave the music a bit more energy. I remember in the days when we used to drive the chart show as it came up from the IRN line from London in mono. We'd play the records live over the feed so we could give our listeners stereo. We'd even do the occasional remix when the right song came on. Now, I'm very fortunate to oversee the international activities of the Walt Disney Company, arguably one of the most creative companies in the world. And whether it's Radio Disney, Disney Channel, ABC, ESPN, Pixar, or Marvel, the Walt Disney Company has creativity at its heart. Many of the lessons I learned at Piccadilly, and later working for Richard Branson, radio, anybody? And Ted Turner have stood me in good stead. Disney thrives because creativity is placed front and center for everything we do, whether it be a new theme park attraction, movie, TV, or radio show. We even have a division called Imagineering, where some of the brightest engineers and scientists work alongside some of the greatest creative minds to invent new attractions and ways to engage our guests. At Pixar, there's a brain trust. It's a creative council that can be called together by any director to help solve a problem or an issue that he or she may be having. So as Lee Unkrich was working for the last 3 years on Toy Story 3, when he hit a roadblock, he could call together all the other creative minds who would work to help to solve that problem. There's no egos, total honesty, and total transparency. For those of you who've seen Toy Story 3 and other Pixar movies, you know how that process works. But there are other not so apparent things that Pixar does to promote creativity. Animation can be a lonely occupation, just like being a DJ. The building you're working at Pixar is specifically designed with a central hub where all the mail, food, toilets, and other services are located. It forces people to come together and stimulates interaction. Whether you're a lawyer or an animator, you have to meet in the central hub. I actually think the location and layout of the original Piccadilly building in Piccadilly Gardens played a big part in stimulating the creativity and a connection with the listener. Today, in the businesses that I oversee and the several thousand employees that I oversee, I still try to create an environment where creativity is applauded, where failure is tolerated and risk-taking accepted. How many times are there people with great ideas who remain silent for fear of ridicule? At Piccadilly, everyone, from the receptionist to the engineer, was encouraged to get involved and contribute. Today, everything seems so sanitized and regimented. Radio today seems like an iPod with a voice. Tight playlists, strict rotation, and DJs who aren't allowed to express much creativity. Music's universal, so what makes radio special? Not that much in many cases. The business principles I employ today were formed at Piccadilly and during my time working for my first boss, Timmy Mallett. Timmy and I met Chris after he followed us back from an OB in Warrington and pretended to work for hospital radio. I suspect you've all read about it in Chris's book. He joined the team and, as you've just heard, became known to us simply as Nobby. The boss of Piccadilly at the time was Colin Walters, who'd helped start the station with Philip Birch and others. I have to be honest, I didn't have much to do with Colin as I was so junior, but I did get to drive his Jag down to London one time and was so excited that I literally nearly fell off the end of the M1 when I arrived in London, because I didn't realise the motorway ended and I was going a tad fast. I'm thankful that I didn't crash and grateful to Colin for agreeing to appear today at a radio event for the first time in 21 years. And Colin, I'd like to start with you, if I may. When you and Philip started PIC, did you have a master plan? What did you have in mind as you were starting the radio station?
Well, somebody must have had a master plan, but it wasn't me. In fact, I can remember walking across the Piccadilly Plaza, where the studios were located, just before the station went on air, and thinking, I wish somebody had told me what it is they want me to do. Because I had been working before for BBC Radio Nottingham, which was like radio for the crematorium, really. And this was a totally new idea. And I had a sort of a working idea in my mind, which sort of would make it, like Radio 1, lots of pop, lots of funny games, but also local. And I thought that combination would probably work reasonably well. But it wasn't any more scientific than that. And I think if I was managing director of that radio station all over again, what I would do is I would have to be much more structured in what I asked my program controller to do, in terms of audience achievement, but also in terms of the sort of radio station that I was looking for. But Philip was incredibly relaxed. I'm astonished now about it. I once said to him, I'm thinking of doing an all-speech breakfast show. This is on a pop radio station. I'm thinking of doing an all-speech breakfast show. He said, yeah, okay, well, we'll give it some thought and see how it pans out. Because I didn't do it. But I really feel that any managing director has got to have some broad structure that he talks to his program controller about. We want it to be this, we want it to be that, we want it to be da 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 da. And I'm sure that's what happens nowadays, but it didn't happen in those days.
And when you were assembling the talent, were there any criteria you were looking for?
Yeah, but it didn't work quite like that at the beginning, because the amount of talent knocking around was very, very limited. And so a lot of the people we employed, or I employed, I guess, were former pirate radio DJs and some former BBC local radio people and stuff like that, and they really weren't very good, and it became apparent fairly quickly that they weren't very good and they had to be released or shifted into a nighttime show or whatever it might be, which is in effect being released, obviously. But then gradually, as the years went by through the late 70s and early 80s, pulling in a range of much more talented and much more relevant to the local market, people who may not have been DJs before, but they were personalities, and they came over on air as personalities, some of them sitting in the audience today. Thank you, Chad, for coming.
So, Timmy, you were one of those DJs that came along from Radio Luxembourg. What are your early impressions of when you joined Piccadilly and you wanted to start Timmy on the tranny and you had to deal with Mr. Walters and Mr. Ingham?
Okay, well, my first meeting with Colin actually was before that, when I was at BBC Radio Oxford, and they were about to offer me a staff job. And Colin said, come and do a couple of weeks overnight, so I want to see how you are as being a DJ. And in those days, there was the DJ on air, and there was the engineer who'd go around back and have a kit. And one of the jobs was about five or six in the morning, you had to pop out and pick up the newspapers which arrived at the top of the escalator. So I put the album on and went out to get the newspaper, and the door slammed shut. The album played all the way through. going out, and I'm thinking, that's the end of my life, I'll never get another job. And finally the engineer woke up and let me back in, and I waited for the wrath of God to descend. And so that's the first news we've ever missed.
See, what was important to me, it wasn't you being off air, it was the fact we missed the news.
Yeah. So, it's a waste of time doing the rest of the shows, isn't it, really? Just read the news out. I came back to Piccadilly to do this show after Radio Luxembourg's 2 month stint just finished in 1982. And it was Tony, I think, Tony and Colin, who said, right, do this Saturday lunchtime show. That was Saturdays, football, chips. Fish and chips, right, well, we'll do it down at Gilbert's Chippy. I recorded some sound effects of a chip shop and did the show as live from a chip shop, and we gave away fish and chip suppers. And he said, that's all right. Okay, now then, I want a teenage pop show. Teenage pop show, just bring me an audience. And that was the instruction. I think it's remarkable how little instruction was, just do it. Okay, well, the very first show, I went on, and Adam and Ant had a new song out called Goody Two Shoes. I think we played it 12 times in 2 hours. Just played it. I like the song, go back and play it again, and again, and again. It's a good song, we'll have that. and the option was, right, get a team of people who are thinking on the same wavelength. You came along, Andy, and Karen Walsh, Auntie Buggy Kneecaps, and some other teenagers who played cleaners, and then Nobby, you turned up and did this interview. I remember the interview, it was a good interview you did with a tape recorder that you borrowed from your brother.
Yeah, it's a Grundig 350 Deluxe, which was heavier than my house. Well, I remember my name, Pete James, I called myself.
Yeah, because
I thought it sounded good. And I even practiced the signature. It sounded a bit like a hairdresser, because hairdressers tend to have DJ names, which is two Christian names, no surnames,
that's
like
right.
Pete James will do. So I thought, I had some Pete James from Warrington Hospital Radio. Of course, I've never been to Warrington Hospital Radio.
You did the interview. It was a good interview. It was funny. You asked some funny questions. How many cars you got, you said. And one of the questions was, which are better, newts or tadpoles? And Andy, you just turned up and said, right, by the way, I'm back to university tomorrow. We need somebody to answer the phones and do the logging and all the rest of the stuff. And that's when you wrote in immediately. And you said, oh, yeah, it was funny. That's
I wrote in the next day.
Yes.
And Tony Ingham phoned me, wrote back to me, I can't remember, on the Wednesday, and I came to see him on the Thursday, and I got the job I was working on the Monday.
Yeah.
Being shouted at in an interview.
Immediately, get me a joke, get me a caller, get it now!
In Wharton, it was like going over top.
Yeah. You were very, very tough in terms of the drive that you had for perfection and creativity. You think that was necessary for success?
Anna, you just hit the nail on the head. I would like to say that I, as program controller, was totally responsible for the creativity that was yielded from the shows that these two guys. I was nothing to do with it. I let this guy get on with it because he's got a brain in his head. He's got a creative brain in his head. And you just used the words as to how he did it because he knew what he was thinking, about what ideas he had. And he was very tough in terms of discipline. And Chris will testify to that, I'm sure.
I was petrified.
So they would get on with it.
Yeah,
you don't need to ride shotgun on guys like that who can do the show for themselves.
I've never been shouted at like that by anyone. I've done all my day.
No.
And you either, you were sink or swing it.
Yeah.
You usually found out in probably a night whether we were going to stick around.
Yeah, if you can't come in, you're out.
Yeah, he's so tough. I mean, ridiculously tough. But, I think about this on the train up here, I was thinking, okay, how do you say how tough Timmy was? Because I've never worked for anybody since or before who was that hard on the people I worked with. But the mitigation is that no matter how tough he was on us, he was tougher on himself. Because he was asking for one thing off us, you know, me answering the phones or you producing or Auntie Bunny Kneecaps in the character. And we were struggling for that one thing by the end of the record. I need it and I need it now. I need it now. No option. The plane's going to crash. I need it now. And you had to deliver it, whatever it was. And so as we're trying to deliver one thing. He's got seven things for the next link. So he's putting all that pressure on him. Now, I think now, what I would say is, if one of us had failed to deliver, we're probably 6 layers to that link, it's going to survive. In fact, if the link's got three layers, three out of the seven devices, it's going to work. But we didn't know that at the time. Mm. So whatever pressure you put on us, the mitigation is, and I think where it's okay to do it, is that you're putting more pressure on yourself.
I think what's one of the other things that really stands out for me was the amount of preparation that you drilled into us that went into what looked like a totally anarchic 3 hours of radio. Every single piece of, as soon as that microphone was opened, was cleverly crafted and scripted and researched and preppy books. And there was maybe worth you talking a little about how you approached, you know, channeling all these ideas together to create entertaining radio.
Prep is vital, and I learned that from watching Andy Wright at BBC Radio Oxford and then Rob Jones at Luxembourg. They would scribble down ideas. I said, what are you doing? I'm cutting bits out of Tidbits magazine. There's a gag here I'm going to use. I'm going to rewrite it and use it. Why? Well, because it's material, and you can use material, but so material doesn't come miraculously. You have to work at it. Oh, okay. So you're constantly jotting ideas down, gags and ideas. Preppy books are just brilliant for ideas. You might not use them all, but if you're stuck for something, flip through there. Oh, I haven't used that gag for a little while. I'll use that again and I'll redo it. And you get into the habit of constantly thinking about how you can take a new story, a current thingy in the news today, and retell it in a way that stirs the imagination, because radio is all about imagination, isn't it?
Yeah, but also, I mean, it's like going to the gym. You know, the more ideas you come up with, the more ideas you will come up with. And also you get less pressure about those ideas.
Yeah.
So if we come to you with 10 ideas
and
you think they're all crap
that
we spent 2 hours working on, well, you just get used to the rejection, which is what you're talking about there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the fear of failure or the getting used to not worrying about failing because you're a machine, you can come up with those more ideas. I mean, you know, when I went and worked at another place afterwards, I used to get people who were in a similar situation to what I was for you, working for me, and they throw an idea out. And they say, but I've been working there now. So, oh, can we even work in a year or a minute? It's irrelevant. You know, we need another one. Now.
Now! Get on with it!
So, meanwhile, Colin, you've got this great talent both in front of the microphone and behind the microphone, and you're balancing what's being produced out on the air with trying to make revenue from ad sales. Was there ever any times when you tried to temper what was appearing on air with the money-making piece?
Recognised I would never, never, never try to make money. I told you I came from the BBC. It's a completely alien world to me. And when, I mean, for instance, I get any number of stories. Once when some people came from an advertising agency, came around with the Burks managing director, and went with me into the traffic department and played some commercials that they had produced for the advertising people. And I had listened to these commercials on air, and I thought, oh shit. They were complete shit. And Philip's going, and don't you think they're great guys? And suddenly I realized, Jesus, you have to tell these people complete lies. Because it's complete nonsense. In fact, the commercials were rubbish. But, you know, that was part of the game. And what was your question?
So as you've got all this creative talent, did you ever worry? I don't know what the answer is, but did you worry about me?
All I can assume that Philip thought things are going great, moving in that direction, going up the hill, and let's just live with that while we can. You know, that while the audiences are getting bigger and bigger and bigger all the time, that's fine, we can sell that to the advertisers. And that's what, so it never impacted on me at all.
It was easy to sell Piccadilly because it was a big station and it looked and sounded big. Its location in the heart of Manchester with those photos, larger than life, mm-hmm. was absolutely key and crucial to the whole thing. And if you look around radio stations today, you say, now where are they? Are they big in the centre of the city? No, you take Wave in Swansea, it's out in the middle of the Gower Peninsula, a little shed. The big stations today, well, there's very few of them. I mean, if you go to Liverpool, there's the big Radio City Tower, and that looks fantastic. It looks like, whoa, here we are, right in the centre of the city. You go down to reception at the bottom, and it's a dump. If you go to BBC Stoke, has a good location. That's at the top of Hanley High Street, and it looks like a media city. It looks really impressive. You go, wow, this is happening, and it's in Stoke-on-Trent. Wow. But, well, capital used to be huge, didn't it? When when it was in Euston Tower, and now it's just behind a Starbucks in the middle of Leicester Square. If you're looking for magic, you can't find it because it's in some high street thing. Where are the London radio stations? Do you know where they are? Does anybody stand outside waiting for autographs? We had kids standing outside Piccadilly waiting for autographs.
Yeah.
That clip you had before, that's one of several hundred tapes that Rachel Blurton, a listener, recorded with the pause button on her cassette, and she's still got them. Who records radio shows now? Who, why would you do it? Because where's the bigness to listen to?
Well, you will, yeah. I mean, they don't have to record it because it's the iPlayer that they've got from Melody. They're lazy, those listeners.
So, I think they're still involved in the radio business a little bit. Understandably so. How, are we just wallowing in nostalgia and thinking that, those were the halcyon days back 30 years ago, and radio is different today? Or do you still think that there's as much creativity going on in what you're, not just what you're doing, but what you listen to?
Well, first of all, I just need to excuse myself as far as this panel is concerned, because there's people in the audience far more qualified than me to work on the radio. Dave Ward's in the audience, by the way. And Brian Beach, who ran the promotions and drove the finances, he's used to shout at us all the time, and he's still shouting at us now. But I was a little helper, wasn't I? I did get a show. I got a couple of swing shifts. I did Night Beat forever. Night Beat was hilarious. Just a quick word about Night Beat, just in case you don't know about it. 2 till 6, and everybody cut their teeth on Night Beat. It was a great show to get if you cut your teeth. Night Beat was 2 a.m. till 6 a.m. 5 days a week. You were allowed to play 6 Needle Time records. 6. That was it for 4 hours. And you had to play lift music or panpipes. And so what some of the DJs did is they played 1.5 or 2 records per hour, and they do their DJ romantic links around those. But I thought, fuck it. I'll play them all straight off at 2 o'clock. So at least the first half of proper radio. And I'm hoping he was listening, or Tony was listening, or somebody was fucking listening. They never were fucking listening. So I just want to say that the people in the audience, I feel a bit of a fraud up here at the moment. But anyway, so as far as creating, we're not wallowing in it, no. But there were more opportunities then. It was sexy then, wasn't it? Because you had regional accents on music radio stations, which you didn't have because you had public school middle class accents on national radio stations playing music, and then you had regional accents on local stations not playing much music. And I remember the Piccadilly 261 logo, which for me was part of the deal, because it looked cool, it's a really good graphic, do you remember?
Yeah.
It was really funky, it could have been off a Pink Floyd album or something,
yeah.
It just all worked. And Pete Baker was the breakfast DJ, came to Warrington, and he was the breakfast DJ, but he did a Saturday afternoon series of OB, and he did it from Dixon's window. And I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I just looked at Pete Baker, who I thought was the coolest bloke ever. And I remember going to, I entered the competition, this is not the answer to the question. I remember I entered the competition for Triumph and Onions, which was a Sunday morning kids show. I answered 3 questions about height. One was, how tall is the post office tower? Horses measured in, and what's the highest mountain in Great Britain? I can't remember telling the tower, but it was Hans and it was Ben Nevis. And I went to collect the space offer, and that was because I won a space offer. And I sat in reception to be on a Wednesday, because I had to go down for the Wednesday, so I was going to take it and put it out on Sunday. And Roger Day came out. Fuck me! That was like seeing God. Roger Day came out and he said, he had a UO tape machine because he'd been doing that recording. And he said, hi, what was that lovely gingerhead receptionist that used to work? Pat. He said, hi, Pat. I went, fuck, it's Roger Day. That's all I ever heard him say in the flesh, still to this day. Oh, God. And then Phil Wood would come in and out. And the point of all this fact, there is some sort of basis in the response to your question, is the fact that that's how magical the stations were for the listeners.
Yeah.
You know, and it must, that's not based on nothing. That must be based on something special coming out of the speaker, because there was other stuff to do then. And it was about creativity. You know, as good as Timmy was, and as brilliant as Timmy was on TOTT, Gary Davis was before you in school and college rock. He used to do Tuesdays, Thursdays. Before him, Andy Peebles did the Legendary Soul Show. Before that, Mike Shaft did Taking Care of Business, which I didn't realise, was a back reference to Barry White. And I only found out the other day, when I appeared with him on stage in Hyde Park, that Taking Care of Business was the name of fucking Elvis Presley's band. I didn't know that. So Mike, obviously, did you know that?
No.
So Mike obviously did a bit of that. And then Dave Ward, it was all about creating pictures. When I used to listen to the radio and and listen to Timmy. All I could see was pictures. I couldn't hear a sound. I could just see pictures. And Dave Ward did UTVC under the bedclothes.
Horizontal
fence. I honestly thought Dave was broadcasting from a fucking four-poster bed. And I was devastated when I went and found out that he wasn't. And Naughty Neville, he was the dodgiest radio character there's ever been. He should have been arrested for curb crawling every night. He went around Manchester trying to find women to come and horizontal dance in Dave's CD alarm in the radio. So the answer is yes. No, we're not one of them. It really was brilliant. Isn't that
yeah.
Right?
And you look at radio personalities today, a lot seem to be focused on breakfast. You know, we were going last night, we were trying to name through, well, who are the personalities
well,
around
plenty,
today?
But there are a lot of personalities in radio. There's plenty. There's yourself, Nobby. But, you know, on London stations, you've got Johnny Ford, and you've got Jamie Thigpen, and you've got... I used to love George Lamb on BBC Six Music. He was crazy.
I like
that. Fantastic stuff. But then where's the big, strong personalities later in the day or in the evening? The teenage pop shows, the things that celebrate their youth and vibrancy, if you like, that's not on air. What we have now is the top 8 and 8, and it's 8 tedious songs that you never heard of, and there's one link at the beginning, it's a pre-recorded link at the end, and somebody's gone off surfing the internet looking at porn in the middle.
Nothing wrong with that. Times.
Anyway, but the point is, there should be room for some creativity in as well as a simple personality radio. It's not simple personality, no. Personality is really important in radio. Really important. But creativity is too.
It's going to be born out of creativity, that's the thing.
I hate this word, creativity.
Do you?
There was a session just before lunch today, and there was a chap, he might have been from BBC for all I know, who the chairwoman asked him, what are you going to do later on today? He said, I'm going to do one thing creative every day. I've never, ever sat down at a desk and thought, now let's do something creative. Yes, I'm doing, you do the things,
yeah.
You come up with ideas, sparky ideas of one sort or another.
Well,
and then you look back, and you think, well, that was pretty creative.
Yeah.
But afterwards, you know, you sort of, it doesn't work like clockwork. It works just that.
It's nevertheless creative.
Well, it may be.
But this so you've created an environment where failure is tolerated. You know, you come out and everyone in that organisation, from the receptionist all the way through.
If you put a safety net under the trapeze, it's not going to be that exciting.
Yeah.
And what commercial radio has to do, because it has to deliver a certain demographic, which is ever narrowing and ever more finite, And as the listening figures are going down, they have to increase the number of adverts. What's going to suffer? Entertainment and risk. And I did an interview with a guy on GZFM last year, and he does the late night show. And I said, so you're pre-recording in the day. I said, so what's it like late at night? He said, I don't know, I've never been here late at night. And he did the show 5 nights a week, because all the links have to be pre-recorded.
Yeah.
It's just down
into our computer.
It's all digitally done. He does 4 pre-recorded links an hour. And I said, so when are you going to do live show? He said, I don't know. He said, I've never done a live show. And he's been doing it for 2 years, this show. Because that's not the way it is. So I just think it's very sad. It's inevitable. But I think that these things are cyclical. And things can get so safe up to a certain point that they become completely unappealing to everybody. And then it's like an earthquake. And then it has to change. And I think it will change. And I think it happens with breakfast shows become very speech-based. Then the speech is too much. The research creates that they want more music. So then they become very music-based, and 5 of them become very speech-based, and I think that will happen. I hope to God that will happen.
All right, I want to open up to questions.